Tiburgon's gluteal muck is thus made passable, the ferrets, the Tyutopian employees, shall recant the anthills that you hear chiming together. If Ty Spurt uses a raspy milieu in the age of protein, if the defamation fracas constantly knitting onlookers hit by boundaries and clues in your felt winks grabs the whale of Thai dystopias by the antlers, then use the breaking spurt of Thailand for the whole entry from which Thailand spurts. Use the desolate silo proteins of Thai bids. Knit onlookers, wet their boundaries until she sues for accords. Thai viewers whine about the issues that the Thai projector fuels. Psychosocial problems.
Did you make use of any natural processing language in the creation of these poems?
Yeah, actually, what I would do is I switched all the vowels around, but then I would spell check. I think I spent 6 months of my life waking up in the morning and spell checking. And whenever the spell check in Microsoft Word couldn't spell check the words that I had resorted, I would reassociate. After that, I re-engineered the grammar because it was grammatically completely off.
What's for you the relationship between literature and biology?
Oh, well, that actually, believe it or not, well, I kind of have an answer for everything. So here we go. Dadaist poetry and mutation have some things in common. So bioinformatics is databasing or big data genomes, hopefully entire biomes like the ocean. But the actual language of DNA, which has only say 20 letters, 20 amino acids, but lots of different triplets. But it's still based on random chance, but the random chance adds up to things like elbows. It adds up to things like scent glands. It adds up to things like fur. So on a morphological level, if we are to believe that we are a code or a language, what's expressed is actually our anatomy, even our cognitive abilities. What's expressed is our ability to act and react to the environment, to be in this place. And at the same time, we are that Dadaist poem, okay? Because not everything that's left in our genome is left there because of fitness or survivability, that biosociological urge to say that everything's there for a reason. Actually, a lot of us is a lugubrious game. A lot of our anatomy is excess. It's just based on wild expenditure of life energy, right? We actually have extra in our behavior, in our anatomy, and in our way of being in the world. Even our reproductive style is based on excess. So there's more energy than is necessary for this system to just survive, all right? I'm not getting all Protestant about this. We have a party, right? We're exuberance. Mm-hmm. So let's accept that we have wild excellence and wide ranges of flexible abilities that come from random generations of texts. We are living wild poetry, right? How's that?
Okay, just bring to me another question, which is junk DNA and so on. But let me just come back to the alteration of human genes. So but while listening to you, I get the feeling that for you, there's an infinite possibilities of variation and alteration of all living beings. You are aware that this is highly controversial, right? That most of the people will actually fight with you. So, how do you see this this hubris dimension of bio artists, and how do you address that question of hubris and exuberance, as you said?
Well, I mean, I would rather someone have some reaction than no reaction at all. But I have to say, yeah, it is somewhat unusual. If we look at the history of art and we think about where the aesthetic of utility and cleanliness and sort of cleaning our genome to make ourselves more healthy, that fall under minimalist conceptual art. We have art form, and then like a subset of minimalist conceptual art would be science, right? It's actually a process whereby you arrive at one small iota of a fact through like a long process-based, almost ritualistic repetition compulsion, right? but is like an Excel graph or, you know, a chart that shows the locus. It's beautiful, but it's just one art form. I don't think that thinking about the infinite possibilities can hurt anything. We actually have opened up a sort of Pandora's box. Why wouldn't we call that the box of Pandora as opposed to the box of future health applications? The language that I've heard a lot when people are presenting is the language of scientists trying to avoid legislation or corporate CEOs trying to avoid a public reaction. Those are very different from the actual of the technology, right? The technology itself has an actual potential, and it's not based on avoiding legal structures or, you know, maximizing profit or, in particular, saving face. Artists are really good. We don't have to save face. We're not paid enough to save face. So we're allowed to say, like, you know, there's an elephant in the room, and maybe we can take some genes from that elephant and grow a trunk. And there are people in India that would love to see Ganesh trunks on some of, you know, think about the how many alms you could get or what kind of show you could put on. It saves a lot in makeup, etc. But there are also people that identify, you know, as trans. And I don't mean transgen, like transgendered. There are also people who identify as transgenic. I had a friend who was transgendered, and he, who became a she, also identified as Jesus, as a female Jesus. And I said to her, it's beautiful that you've transitioned to a woman, but wouldn't you like a Jesus change too? She said, how would that happen? And I said, maybe we can engineer that stigmata come out on your forehead and on your hands around Easter every year. We'd need like the circadian rhythm and some way to, like, you know, I mean, there's a gene for stigmata, you know, and there's placements on your body. There's body clan genes, HOX and PAX. So opening up actuality of application necessarily, you know, I wouldn't find it easy to demonize. The problem is that, you know, people are a little bit freaked out by GMOs in general, right? And there are reasons for that.
Yeah.
I mean, there are real reasons for that. Usually, it's unusual, say, we know that dogs will hump almost anything, right? And if a dog was humping a pig, you'd look at that and you'd say, ew, that's gross. You know, that dog is humping that pig. You know, how does that figure? I can't figure that in a biological. That obviously has nothing to do with reproduction. Unless you're actually taking dog genes and putting them into pig embryos or pig's embryonic stem cells and manufacturing a pig with dog genes in it, in which case you have had a kind of interspecies, some people call it bestiality, we could just call it, you know, interspecies love, that is actually capable of becoming a dog pig or a dig or a pig dog or a pog. And for some reason, people find that to be a little bit frightening.
Are you in line with this idea of the extinction? If I understand well, but the possibilities of, you know, you talk about the design from of ancient myth or historical figures. So for you, the use of transgenics technology could serve to bring back to life dead species, everything.
Well, I mean, this brings us back to psychosocial problems of transgenic humans. We're dealing with a lot of narcissism here, right? I mean, just... it's a little heavy-handed to redesign the human genome according to, you know, your corporation's whims. You know, we're in this world where if you can buy it, money talks, right? And so people do want to have clones of themselves. But there's nothing like being born with the expectation that you're going to be the next David Bowie, right? It's sort of like this really unfortunate thing to put on a kid. Like, I spent $10,000 to make you the next Bowie, and you just happen to look like Bowie, but you want to be a mathematician, you know, or just be anonymous. So the pressures on these transgenic delayed twins, which are what clones are, I think that's a lot. That's a lot of parental expectation. Nonetheless, we were born to parents that had expectations of us also. And, you know, that comes down to sort of utilitarian ethics, like what's practical. But I would think if someone wanted an ego boost, a narcissistic ego boost, and they had money, that they would want to have as many children as possible. Not necessarily delayed twins or clones of themselves, but children with as many mothers as possible, so that they would have a founder effect. Like Genghis Khan, was, you know, he and his brother and his dad like had more kids than anyone on Earth so far, and they're everywhere. You can get a Scottish accountant in Florida with Genghis Khan genes. So really, I'm starting to think of offering something called tribe building, where, you know, you could give your sperm or give your eggs, and we'll grow you 1,000 or 2,000 kids. And for the right price, you don't even have to meet them until they get out of high school. You know what I mean? You can come be the guest speaker at their high school graduation and say, by the way, I am your parent. I would think that would be more effective if you're trying to leave a genetic legacy than just reproducing stardom. And that reproduction of stardom would be what? For lookalikes in reruns of movies, etc. So if you want a tribe built, I'm thinking I can make you 1,000 kids to 18.0. They'll be ready in about 20 years, and it's like $40, $50 million. For a lot of people, that's not too bad. I mean, that's really, if you want to leave a legacy, build your tribe with me.
This is an open call. I'm interested in the narrative side of your practice as a bioartist. And since the beginning of the recording of this podcast, you've been reading some poems. So I'm really interested in the narrative, in the speculative side of bioarts. So do you think that it is because it's too conceptual that many artists actually use a narration to try to make it more concrete and familiar for the audience?
Well, I would say that wet lab bio, actually working on a lab bench, performing something like an experiment that's maybe repeatable, maybe not repeatable, but that takes focus and techniques, the learning curve is high for the people that want to practice that. But when it comes to bringing the techniques to the public, it's actually easy to access the feeling of what it means to run a microinjector or an electroporator, because they're not that different from, say, a blender or a straw. A lot of times, the mystification of science is not religious, but it's technical. It's techno-mystification, and demystifying the techniques is not that part. One of the things, though, that I hear you talking about is, what is this relationship to new media and speculative thought? I mean, when it comes to the sort of object-oriented speculative realism, bioart's at a very strange place, because, number one, the concepts are very speculative, but it is a return to the real. In other words, the sculptures are alive, and the sculptures are having some sort of cognitive interaction with the world. The sculptures are not artifice. In fact, it diffuses the art itself. In some ways, the artifice is gone. The artifice of art is made real again, and it's looking a lot like a repulsive piece of snot, or it's looking a lot like a stillborn animal in development that was born halfway and then died in some sort of half pain. Or these organisms are looking like, you know, glowing rhesus monkeys in a cage. It's Salvador Dali's dream come true. In some ways, we have the surrealist dream come true, where anything you can think of can be actualized. But we have this problem. You can't actualize everything. That's like actualizing the infinite. And also, once it's actualized, it is a being, and it has a bit of a problem with your dream being imprinted upon it. You know, it's not an it. It's a we. It's a part of our life world. And this construction metaphor, you know, this metaphor of inserting data into the genome through a USB port is actually, it's a little bit superficial when you're talking about what it's like to be alive under someone else's artistic design. So you run into this problem of the return of the real is that problem of imagination coming back to talk at you. Your dreams actually turning into, you know, a whining child that drools, that, you know, needs to be washed, that needs to be fed.
You've been attending the summit about human gene editing in Washington, D.C., I think, last month. What was the outcome of
that? Well, the outcome was that cautiously scientists should be allowed to continue research on editing the human genome, but that no embryos mm-hmm. should be grown past a certain date. Usually it's 7 days or 14 days. In other words, no children should be born of this technique until it is more optimized, that there are less mistakes and less mm-hmm. Deleterious effects from the technology. The aim is to come up with a protocol for putting genes into the human genome that doesn't disrupt the human genome in any deleterious way, so that it's just cut and paste, right? As opposed to mm-hmm. chromosomes getting cut at the same time and the paste causing cancer, etc. But there were other things going on at that conference. There were other momentums, and some of it was quite philosophical, and some of it was quite business-oriented, and some of it had to do with limiting how much legislation should be put on this. In other words, the scientists are managing to write the laws for this technology.
We're getting close to the end of the podcast. I think we have passed the time, but let me just ask you that question, because I didn't quite exactly understood what was your take on aesthetics and issues of control. I think that's how you phrased it earlier when I asked you why artists and designers should have a word on those discussions. You said that you was interested by these issues of controls, if I understood well. Why should artists and designers have a word on the aesthetics of manufactured products that science basically invents?
Wow. That's the first time I didn't understand what you said. Say it again.
Why would artists and designers would have something to say about the outcomes of science in terms of synthetic biology and transgenics?
Well, I mean, for one thing, the first knee-jerk simple answer for an artist like myself would be to say, we need to diffuse neo-eugenics, right? This is a new kind of master racing. We need to make sure that there isn't a singular master and that there isn't a singular race that comes out of this. We're dealing with a post-race world where a sort of synthetic enhancement is coming on board. And I'm a little bit worried, okay? The other answer to that question, though, on the other hand, is that we need creative thought to go into this, because we're starting to engineer ourselves. And if this really becomes sort of like a Mad Lib project for the human genome, where people are making jazz out of what was, you know, a slow hereditary process, is now speeded up and going in many directions. We need to have a range, a real range, you know? We need exuberance and morphology and even non-Karen design sets. And this is where sort of architecture mm-hmm. of the body comes in. This is where the new design comes in. But I'm not so gung-ho about all that. You know, I come off that way, but in a lot of ways, what I'm interested in also is what is the control economy to begin with? In other words, by calling what's going on art, I'm actually opening up a wider way of speaking about what is going on in the name of health. And I don't think it's in the name of health. It's a larger project, and mm-hmm. it needs to be discussed in a more, you know, in a less superficial way than science is discussing.
Thank you so much, Adam Zaretsky, for your time and availability today, and for this wonderful setup that the listener couldn't see. But
we'll put it online.
Okay. Sounds good to me. Would you have a last poem to read?
You want a last poem?
Maybe.
Okay,
maybe
this is strange.
To conclude.
I'm going to call this a poem now. These are the places in humans and outside of humans that genes can be put in. So first of all, we have our whole bodies. Women and men, including their germ cells, like their ovaries and their testicles inside of them. We have just ovaries and testicles outside of the body. You don't need a body. You could just have ovaries and testicles. Then there's sperm and eggs in situ or in vivo, in plastico, in a dish. You just have sperm and eggs. You can also mix them together, and then you get zygotes, like post-fusion, even blastulas. All of these can be targeted for genes, and after you take the blastula and kind of cut it up with a razor like it was a little bit of cocaine and then kind of put it into solution, you have human embryonic stem cells. You can grow them in tissue culture, and you can infect them and sort of sort them. And then there's developing human embryos, that are already inside a body or pre-implantation embryos. And finally, there's primordial germ cells, pre-sperm and pre-egg, spermatogonia and oogonia. And these are the targets where the infective genes have to be targeted into to infect in order to make transgenic humans. So these are the places, to the spaces that are available for us to interfere with the hereditary cascade, that waterfall.
Thank you very much.